Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Mrs. Davis, the second grade teacher began, I'm afraid Emily's beginning to fall behind her classmates in her reading. I have some names of diagnostic testing centers and tutors you might want to contact. This is the kind of phone call that can send any parent into anxiety. From a parent's perspective, where should we turn for help? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Today we have two experts to talk with us about testing and tutoring. Paul Pennyman taught for 10 years in public and private schools and headed the math department at the Edmund Burke School. Since 1990, he has run his own independent tutoring service. He edits the newsletter Mathematics Teaching Today. We're glad to have you with us, Mr. Pennyman.
Thank you.
Dr. Laurie Dietzel, a clinical psychologist, is co-director of Diagnostic and Psychological Services for the Kingsbury Center, a private nonprofit center for children. She administers and interprets educational and psychological tests for children who have possible learning disabilities, attention deficit hyperactive disorders, developmental delays, or social or emotional difficulties. Welcome, Dr. Dietzel.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Dr. Dietzel, how do parents know if a child needs tutoring?
Certainly, if your child is falling behind or struggling in one or more classes, you might want to consider tutoring. Also, there's other circumstances in which if your child, for example, has missed any significant portion of school due to illness, other factors, even a move, something like that, might just be a little behind. Tutoring might provide some additional support and instruction that would be useful.
I think it's significant if a school brings the issue up first. Often parents will come to me. Recently, just a few days ago, someone said, well, I think my daughter needs a little extra support. When I saw the girl, she had done A's on every test until this one test, and it was clear there was just this one little blip. So parents can get a little over-anxious. A lot of students are pushed into courses that are too difficult, and then they struggle. But if a school is looking at it from an unbiased viewpoint, and they think there might be a problem, then it's an issue worth pursuing, I think.
I know another circumstance that parents have often found helpful, especially for their older children and adolescents, when homework becomes a real struggle. Even a child who's doing quite well, but they have a good amount of homework to do, they might want to consider tutoring to take the homework supervision and assisting with schoolwork out of the parent-child relationship and hand that over to somebody else. Often, in fact, especially for teenagers, it's easier for them to accept help from somebody who's not a parent, and that can be another good use of tutoring.
In the situation that you were talking about, Mr. Pennyman, would it be appropriate for that child to meet with somebody one or two times just to get over whatever it was that that child was having an issue with?
Well, in my case, I think it was helpful to see me once, that situation with the girl who just had that one bad test, because I pointed out to her that the teacher was giving fairly hard tests, harder than the homework. And I pointed out these harder problems in each section the kid could practice. So it's often just a little outside consulting might be able to help. But that's something that she could have received if she had gone to the teacher and said, look, I'm having this problem. What should I do if there, in fact, is a problem? It seems like sometimes the whole communication within the school is circumvented when the parents come in and say, oh, there's a problem. We have to go outside. We have to get X, Y, or Z advocates involved. I think sometimes you can just solve the problem within the school somehow.
Another option for a student who simply needs some additional structure to get their homework done, to really work on projects, might be to consider if it's available in your school or privately a couple of times a week to do an after-school program that has some adult supervision and might have the opportunity, which is you do your homework, work on your projects, and maybe get some additional help if needed. But that can be in a small group setting rather than, for example, individual tutoring. And some mentoring programs, other programs, again, may have an academic support component that some students might respond well to.
Okay. Mr. Pennyman, how about students who are just plain disorganized or who are thrown by quizzes or tests or long papers?
Well, there is a bit of research about what I would call a chronically disorganized child, and I think it is really helpful for whoever is helping that kid to be somehow involved with the school environment. I know when I was an advisor at a private school, it had to be someone within the school. An advisor could be helpful in sitting down with the kid, going through the notebook, making sure things are organized. If you're not intimately familiar with the teachers and the curriculum and just the nuances of the school, it's very difficult for someone from the outside to be particularly helpful, I think.
Dr. Dietzel, would you tell us something about the kinds of testing that are used to evaluate a child's specific needs?
I'd be happy to. Usually testing is prompted by a concern or a problem. In general, the types of testing that are done, at least to start with, are cognitive or intellectual tests and then a range of educational tests. These tests are individually administered. They are standardized, which means unlike taking, for example, a group achievement test, which all children take, this would be a more special circumstance. The cognitive and intellectual tests are usually administered by a psychologist. The educational test, and in fact some of the more cognitive and information processing tests, may also be administered by a person who's an educational specialist or diagnostician. The goal of this testing is really to understand your child, to answer questions. And it's important, if you're even thinking about testing and whether or not this would be useful, to really clarify, what do I want to know? What am I worried about? What questions would I want to ask? And it's at that point that you would go to the school, and every child has the right to a free, appropriate education, which includes testing. I think the real goal of testing, though, is to make recommendations. It's only finished when you come to the point of having a good list of where to go from here.
When you face the child who we were just talking about with Mr. Pennyman gets thrown by quizzes or tests, how do you prepare that child to go through the testing process?
Well, we always want the child, even a younger child, to feel comfortable, to be involved. I usually sit down with kids and say, you know, my job is to figure out how you learn best. And I'd like your help with that. And we often will start talking about school and how it goes. And I think kids also often like to really talk about what they're good at, what they like to do, their strengths. It's important that testing not be totally focused on weaknesses and deficits. None of us would like that, especially in meeting a new person and coming into a strange situation. So it's important to, still with kids, lay out the goals. Here's what we'll be doing. Here are the rules of these tests. And here's what I'd like you to do, which is basically just to try your best.
Can I get back to the issue of kids who have trouble with quizzes and tests? I just saw a kid recently who was having trouble in all his tests, and the teacher, of course, said he was doing all his homework and working hard. But there were two problems. The teacher wasn't really looking closely at the homework. So I think the teacher just can't look at this body and say, oh, it was done, and just sort of say the kid is performing with a good effort. The kid was not organizing the work correctly, and the tests were on these mimeographed sheets where there was very little space to work. So all I had to do was ask the teacher, well, can the boy bring in some extra paper and work in an infinite amount of space when he's working on the problems? And that was a big help. But in general, kids who appear to be doing well on homework and who are thrown by tests and quizzes could very well not be performing very well on homework. So the teacher doesn't have to grade every homework problem. That's a waste of time. Or look, you know, micromanage the homework, but just get a sense of how the daily work is going and whether the kid is understanding it on a daily basis. If it can just be a quick look-see every day, that's very helpful for the kids.
Now, the child you spoke of had you as an advocate. I think most of us as parents realize we have to sort of teach our children. They have to learn to do this for themselves, go to the teacher and say, I'm really having a problem.
That's right. It's hard to get junior high kids to do that, but I think as they get older and hopefully they're in an environment in school where they can climb those golden stairs and go talk to, if not the teacher, at least somebody in the school about their problem, that would be nice.
It's a good life skill to learn.
I think this is also where testing can be useful because there's a broad range of what's kind of normal in the developmental spectrum. And it might be, let's face it, that a lot of teenagers have other things on their mind, might be disorganized. I think there's a lot of skills involved in being a successful student. Certainly, not everybody has learning disabilities, but you know, the research says that about 1 in 7 Americans do. So it's also important to understand, is this just an area of weakness? Or it could be motivational. I find, though, often that when children are really taught how to do these things better, they want to be successful. They want to be able to learn how to improve their performance. It is important to do assessment, though, when there really is a question, is this outside of what we would call the normal or expectable range? Does somebody really have such a weakness in some of these skills that they need some accommodations, meaning that some things are done differently, or supports or additional services? So in the case of, let's say, a 15-year-old who's terribly disorganized, whose homework at least she scores, you know, gets A's and B's on, but on tests falls apart, we would want to look in testing at what factors contribute to that. Some people have very poor paper and pencil speed. They just can't work quickly. Yeah. Some people need a lot of time to just internally organize their thoughts. So when we look at the testing versus homework and in-class assignments, sometimes the assessment process can be helpful in understanding where things are breaking down, or then for tutoring, what skills a student needs some extra instruction in or help with.
Dr. Dietzel, how are the results of these tests interpreted, and who do you think should have access to them?
All of the tests used that we're speaking of are individually administered, and that's important. The majority of these tests generate standard scores based on comparing your child to other children his or her age. What's important, though, is that the testing include not just the scores, but clinical impressions, observations, teacher reports, parent reports. The testing or assessment process should not just include the tests themselves, but this is confidential information. What should happen is that a report is generated that includes the test scores as well as the clinical impressions that say, here's what we think is going on, and again, as I've talked about, this is what I feel should happen. This is going to be of help to this student. Who they should be shared with, this is confidential information. I certainly recommend that if the parent feels this information is accurate, portrays their child in an accurate, valid fashion, that it be shared with the school, shared with the tutor, shared with the child, and the person who does the testing should play a big role in giving back some of the results in language that the child can understand and use. And then to go from there, if the child is working with any mental health professionals, I recommend going back to the child's pediatrician.
Parents' perspective.
I don't think it's a parent's job to be their child's friend. It's more of a teacher role.
Being a good parent is hard work.
People have PhDs in astrophysics, but they're helpless with an infant.
Parents' perspective's family-oriented topics give you the tools you need to help you raise your children.
Parents have every right to say we're not going to be a television home.
For practical, user-friendly advice on family issues, tune into Parents' Perspective, hosted by veteran parents Linda Perlis and Sandy Burt.
Mr. Pennyman, how should parents find a tutor to meet a child's needs?
Well, word of mouth works best, I think. I've advertised in various places, and it's hard for me to really visualize a parent just looking at an ad like looking for someone to paint a house. Well, I think I'll hire this person to spend lots of private time with my child to do tutoring. So I think you really have to talk to someone who's had an experience with this person, maybe not another adult who's had a child, a son or a daughter with this person, but has had a lot of experience or knowledge about that person.
What kinds of tutoring are there?
Well, I do mathematics tutoring. There are subject-specific tutors. There are tutors who do anything but math, who help with all kinds of reading and writing and organization.
Now, one child I know had a chemistry tutor long before he took a chemistry class in school. That was sort of an enrichment thing. This was a child who, very young in elementary school, was genuinely interested in chemistry. So that was a different kind of tutoring.
Right. In fact, I was asked a month or two ago to work with a sixth grader whose school had run out of things to teach him. And so I said, okay, well, let's look at various topics in the sixth grade book. Okay, well, that didn't take long to realize that was a waste of time. And then we looked in the seventh grade book. And I brought in all kinds of puzzles and problems. I consulted with heads of math departments at middle schools. And he was getting a little bit tired of the seventh grade book. I mean, it was challenging enough for him, but he really wanted to do something extra. So he became interested in the basketball tournament because there's a lot of mathematics involved. And we spent a week or two just going over all the different mathematical problems and puzzles involved. And he came up with a formula that accurately predicted most of the results of the basketball tournament. It was quite astounding. And I was thinking of either sending it into the Mathematics magazine or to the Basketball Times or something. I wasn't sure where it should go, but maybe I'll just keep it to myself, go to Las Vegas next year. But it can be both. It can be both remedial, and I can see someone who's really gifted and just wants to do more and more.
And if I could add that for students with specific learning disabilities, this is more true in the elementary years, but also as they get older, they may need some very specific types of remedial instruction. For example, students with reading disabilities or dyslexia may not be able to learn to read with either the traditional phonics approach or whole language approach. They may need some of the techniques that are multisensory, sequence, very specific, that not all tutors are trained in. So that's another thing that's important to be aware of. For some learning disabled students, they really need not just more presentations or additional instruction and help. They need different strategies, different ways of learning that information, learning those skills.
I have been helping an eighth grader at a local private school, and they talked me into helping him with everything because they thought I would bond with this boy. And sure enough, I got to a point where it was beyond my expertise. He's going on and on orally about how much he knows about a certain subject. Okay, so we sit down to the computer, and he's not a bad typist for an eighth grader, and he can't do anything. He can't type in a single thought that he has in his mind. And then I realized, well, they need someone to unlock his problem.
Mr. Pennyman, when we're trying to find a tutor, what should we be looking for?
Well, I think you want to match up the personalities to a certain extent. Obviously, the person has to have expertise in the field or fields that the child is having trouble with. A personality match is important. I think a tutor who knows the school and the school's curriculum is helpful. And really, a track record, if you have one or two people who know the person, I think that's very helpful.
Mr. Pennyman, how often should tutoring take place?
Most of my students can see me once a week and within a few weeks show some, if not measurable, progress on the old transcript or record that they have in school. At least they have a change in motivation. If they have what I would call a moderate problem in school that I can help them with, just a couple of pieces of advice, then they can see me once a week. And if they can hold on to their knowledge that I give them or just some strategies that I give them between the intervening 6 or 7 days, that's enough. Occasionally you'll get kids who 2 or 3 days later, because they can't make the connection between what they're seeing with me and what they're having in school, they've lost it. They need to see me again or some sort of extra help, maybe from the teacher if the teacher and I are coordinated. But that's a little bit more unusual.
That's tutoring for reinforcement.
That's right.
How is our communication with the tutor helpful to our kids?
Well, the parents, of course, with the younger kids, the parents have to be pretty intimately involved with what's going on in the sessions. The parents can't be there, really. The kids will become anxious. I'll become anxious. Everyone will be anxious. But there can be follow-up every week if necessary. Really important, though, is for there to be a nice triangle among the student, the teacher, or the teachers, and the tutor, so that the three of them are all on the same page and know what's happening. I tend to wait a week or two before I have a substantive conversation with the teacher just to see if there's been any change. But immediately, the teacher or the school should know that such an intervention is taking place so that the work coming in may be enhanced, let's say. But I tend to wait a couple of weeks before I say, well, has there been any difference? Let's talk about this. Maybe the teacher will have some suggestions or the school will have some suggestions for me. It may go the other way. I might have some suggestions, as I mentioned before, with the extra room to work on the paper.
Dr. Dietzel, when should a parent investigate a child's progress in school? How early in the school year? How often?
I think the answer is continually. And parents have a lot of hard jobs to do, especially if you have more than one child that you're going to be monitoring. I think it's very important to build good relationships with your child's teachers or teacher and with other staff at the school. And I think it's very important. I have parents every day in my office saying, well, you're probably just going to think I'm just too nervous or too anxious, but we just decided to come in because. And often parents are, in fact, very sensitive to knowing when their kids are feeling stressed, when they're not being successful, even if their grades are okay. That's not necessarily the best indicator. It's one indicator, but not the best indicator necessarily of whether or not your child is having difficulties. I see many kids who spend twice as much time on homework as their peers, perhaps, and it's not easy for them. So their grades may reflect that extra work, but not a weakness or a difficulty they're having. So I think good communication is important. And if you have a question, I wouldn't hesitate to call a professional just for a consultation. Use the resources you have right in the school if there's a counselor or a school psychologist.
Mr. Pennyman, would you describe what a tutoring session is like?
Well, I think in the beginning, you want to get to know the student. And as Dr. Dietzel mentioned before, you want to take out the stress, the anxiety, if that's possible. So try to make it as informal at the beginning and as friendly as possible. With the younger kids, I like to play a card game, usually a mathematical card game since I'm a math tutor. But I want to make sure it's not too difficult if they're really having a lot of trouble with math, but just something to get them relaxed. I always tell them I don't let them win because I'm very competitive. So, and the penalty for losing is 5 push-ups, you know, something like that. But generally, we try to look over, if they're in the middle of a school year, try to look over what they've done over the past week, see what problems they've had. Some of them are more self-sufficient than others in saying, well, I've been having trouble with this, or I've been having trouble with this. Some of them bring nice questions. You know, they have these little sticky things in their notebook. Others don't bring anything, and I have to sort of figure out what they did over the last week. Well, we sort of worked with fractions, but it's trying to go over the past week of material and seeing what might come up next and prepare them and just sort of round everything off for them. During the summer, it's a different story. They're trying to get ready for the school year or make up for what they had trouble with in the previous year. So that's totally my province. I will prepare something. I will come up with some sort of mini curriculum and try to go from A to Z and try to have a nice closure at the end so I feel like they've had a little mini course. We're not reacting to what they're learning in school in that case.
Do you have kids who are resistant to tutoring? I'm here because my mom made me come.
It's very difficult to tutor kids whose parents sent them, at least the first time. If I get them to relax and I get them to enjoy it and I make enough stupid jokes, they might want to come back and they might learn something in the meantime. But if it's clear that after 1 or 2 or 3 sessions, and you can read through them, that they really don't want to be there, I will even ask them, well, gee, I'll sort of make up some sort of excuse. You know, you seem to be doing pretty well. Do you think you should come back? And sometimes I'll be surprised. Sure, yeah, this is great. Or sometimes there'll be this great relief on their faces, especially if they're an older kid, and they'll say, well, yeah, I really think I don't need to come anymore. So you really have to judge the kid's age and have a frank discussion with the parents if necessary to see whether it's really beneficial.
And I do think that relationship is so important, both in tutoring and testing, and that's an important role that parents can play. I think if parents aren't comfortable with the person to do testing or tutoring, I wouldn't expect your children to be. So I think that initial interview and that initial contact is important. And, you know, in testing, I'm often surprised at how hard people are willing to work, how hard kids are willing to work. I had a 7-year-old the other day who can barely hold a pencil, who has a significant disability, actually, in writing, in the physical act of writing, who took about 25 minutes to write probably a 4- or 5-sentence story. And I kept giving him an out, saying, you've really tried hard. I appreciate it. We can go on to something else. He just looked at me. He said, I'm going to write you the best story you've ever had. Now, that level of performance isn't always evident in the classroom, but again, the amount of effort that goes into dealing with a weakness like that can be very stressful.
This is a slightly different topic, but we as tutors and also diagnosticians can detect emotional barriers pretty quickly with kids. I mean, it's pretty easy to tell rather quickly if the child is depressed, although we're not clinicians. We have suspicions, and often they're borne out. And often it's emotional barriers that are preventing children from doing work. And so if we can cover all the academic, cross all the T's and dot all the I's, then we can rule out all the academic factors and say, well, it looks like an emotional barrier. And we can alert the parents. We can sit them down or have a gentle conversation with them and say, well, I think counseling might be a good option to unlock some of these problems.
So there's an awful lot in terms of resources for parents to take advantage of with diagnostic testing and tutoring. We are grateful to Dr. Laurie Dietzel and Mr. Paul Penniman for their advice and insights. Thank you for helping us better understand the world of testing and tutoring. Our gift for caller number 1 on our listener poll is a wonderful book, 10-Minute Life Lessons for Kids by Jamie Miller. Please call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 to answer the following question. What experience has your family had with tutors?
We'd like to send you 10-Minute Life Lessons for Kids. Call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573. You can also reach Parents Perspective through your local station or by email to parentspr@aol.com. Or to learn more about us and our book, Parents as Mentors, visit our website, http://i.aol.org. https://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.